Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
Oh. Folks, welcome to Working Class Podcast, sponsored by the one and only R-Kings, the best competition page in the Western Hemisphere. Now, what did you say?
That's the one.
And go ahead, Slice.
This area of Mississippi. And also, we are sponsored by Boutique Infinity Tan and Salon, top of White Rock Road. State-of-the-art sunbeds. Get up and try them out, people. You'll not be disappointed.
Don't say Mr. McConnell. I keep reverting back to like primary school, like 12-year-old me.
Was your you taught you when you
he
were
didn't
a
take,
kid?
He didn't take me. He took
our year.
Yeah, so I was in the elder class, the more misbehaved class.
Obviously.
I was saying to John.
Because you were messed about. That's what happens. Too many subs. Never
is that
forget.
Right? I think if you're gonna teach in school about the road, you sort of have to read from about the road.
Yeah. You get more respect then, don't you? And also, you can relate better with kids.
Yeah.
A lot of middle class people are into teaching as well. You see.
Like, when I went to St. Mary's first to fifth year.
Yeah.
And the teachers, some of them were like. They just sort of talked down to you. They didn't like talk to you as if you were a person. And then see when I moved and went to CBS, the teacher started, they were talking to me as if I was just a normal person, and I actually done better work and got better grades in CBS because of it. Do you know what I mean?
It's changing, but you do get that sort of attitude. You do.
So your book, I keep almost saying Mr. McCann.
Mr. McCann.
Yes, it's I know, but it's because I obviously teach at my school. It's just drilled into me.
That's fine.
And we do think whenever you speak to a teacher years later that they're not allowed to have a life, and you do have a life outside of school.
Yeah.
Whenever I was a kid, you probably felt the same. Slice. You just think teachers go home. And we'll just
mark the books, and then go to bed, and then look forward to getting into class the next day.
That's not the case.
Yeah.
Then you see one of them out in the town.
Well, this is how this podcast has happened. I've heard a lot of stories about Jim, our paths crossing at Dabney's on Saturday, and I was like, mate, I would love to bring you on the podcast. He was like, happy days, we'll get it done. So we're now here, and we'll have on today Jim McCann, which is a former teacher at the school that I attended, and our paths cross on Saturday, and now he's on the podcast, and he's a great story to tell. He has a book out. The book's
6,000 days.
6,000 days is the time you were in jail for.
Well, 6,425, but 6,425 doesn't really ring well as a title.
Matter.
So 6,000 days, you know, does a better job, you know.
So what? How many years is it?
Just over 17 and a half.
So see, back in the day before you, when you went in the jail, were you obviously young. What age would you have been?
19. 19,
yeah. 17 years? So what's that? But you got out when you were 30.
Late 30s.
Did not go to school.
I'm trying to figure all that. The one you're school. What's that say about the teacher?
Yeah. Late 37.
You were in. I need to get this right.
Long cash. Yes. You see, this was part of their policy of trying to change everything. Because Loncash sort of had a bad name as far as they were concerned because of interment and because of the burn and so on. All the things that were associated with Loncash, they wanted to wipe that out. So therefore, they changed the name, hoping that people would forget, right, that this was something different now. There are no political prisoners. And what they had then was a policy called criminalisation, because prisoners would have had a central role in the Republican movement, particularly the Republican base. And they wanted to marginalise us. And the way they did it was through criminalisation. In other words, they're not political. They're just ordinary criminals. And because they're ordinary criminals then, they're not entitled to anything else other than what the ordinary criminals get. So they're going to have to wear what we call the monkey suit, which is the prison gear, but was referred to as the monkey suit or just the gear. And you're going to have to do prison work and you're going to be locked up. You know, you're not going to have the run of the camp and so on. They used to say that the camps, it was like a POW camp, like the cages, there's also known as the compounds in Loncash. That was like a university of terrorism. And it smacked off, you know, the POW camps during the Second World War. So they wanted to expunge that image and create this thing, they're criminals. And the idea was to divorce us from our base. That was the idea. And then, of course, you have the mainstream media coming in behind them, just the way it is today in Palestine, backing them up. So what you would have heard would have been mafia-style shooting, banded country, godfathers, racketeering. That would have been the terminology which we used. Exactly. Yep. They're criminals. They're mafia. That was the idea. That's getting to divorce us from our base. And also prisoners, you know, it was like the soft underbelly of the Republican movement. And they felt if we can break the prisoners, that would have a major impact on the Republican movement and therefore a major impact in the campaign. And that was the idea. So pressure come on, prisoners in. But there was absolutely no way in this world we were ever, ever, ever going to accept that.
We refused to wear the
gear, the monkey suit, the prison gear.
What did you wear in?
What happened was, first of all, political status was removed on March 1st, 1976. So up until that, the lads had political status. IRA would have had their own compounds. They would have had their own wing in Crumlin Row Jail, A wing Crumlin Row Jail. Loyalists would have benefited from that as well. They would have had their own compounds and they would have been in C wing, Crumlin Row Jail. And this all came about from 1972 when Billy McKay and others went on hunger strike and they were granted political status. As they decided they were going to remove that. I was caught in June 76. So the situation there were people I was in the row with would have been in A wing, Crumlin Row Jail, and they would have political status. But because they were caught before March the 1st, a date in the calendar, they had political status, whereas I didn't. So I went into the situation in Crumlin Row Jail where I was put into C Wing. And C Wing was mixed. There was loyalists and there was Republicans. And you have people like Lenny Murphy and, you know, you probably heard another person called, you know, the Glenan gang, a guy called Jackson. They all would have been there. It was really, really tense.
Because you're all in mixed,
but we separated. You know what? We didn't. Obviously, we didn't mix, but we're in the same, you know, yard and the same canteen, and next door to each other in the cells and so on.
Did it ever stop?
But it was a powder keg. You knew it was only a matter of time before it exploded, and that's exactly what happened. On the 12th of July, loyalists wanted to see the 12th on the television, and some of the lads says, no, we want to watch something else. And the thing just went up in the air and it was fighting and loyalists then locked up. And they stayed locked up for quite a while. So we had to run the place. But then what happened as well, because the C Wing Crumlin Row Jail was bung tight, you're talking 40 a cell at this stage. So they had to They moved all the political status guys from A-Wing up to Longcash, and they moved some of us across then to A-Wing. And so we were in A-Wing. Now, we didn't get political status because it was just a matter of getting the status guys out and then using the both wings for really what were political prisoners. You know?
So what did you do to get...
How was it caught? A long story, not going into too much, but what happened was... We were going to do an operation against a policeman. A lot of things went wrong. We got the timing and so on wrong. And also what particularly went wrong was his wife was in the car. We weren't aware of this, you know. Really should have called it off. So we followed him on a motorbike, opened fire on him. And then he opened fire on us, come off the bike. And within a couple of minutes, the police were on top of us because it was on the Lisburn Road. A lot of lads actually caught in the Lisburn Road at that stage. I don't know how many were caught. I mean, you had Mairead Farrell was caught at the Conway Hotel. Sean McDermott was shot dead at the Conway Hotel. Kieran Doherty, who was a hunger striker, managed to get away in that operation. Bobby Sands, Shimmy Finucane, all that. Joe McDonald, they were caught on the Lisburn Road, bombing Balmoral Furniture. Kieran Doherty was eventually caught on the Lisburn Road as well, again with John Pickering and the four others. Was that many people caught on the Lisburn Road in that small intersection? It was just crazy.
Do you think even back in then times in the 70s, or what I mean, people like informing against you or like setting people up for?
I don't think so. No, I don't think so.
Touch got shot.
I don't think so. No. I think it was just like I think it was just we were too predictable. Because it's only a couple of roads to go on the Lisburn Road, because the Lisburn Road was so busy with police and security forces and Brits and so on, you know.
Probably different from the way it is.
And another factor was the conflict, the war was changing at this time because the Brits were sort of way withdrawing somewhat. Around that period, this took place during, you know, the criminalisation. This all changed in 75. Criminalisation, also known as Ulsterisation, where what happened was they wanted to put...
Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend or family member, or an organisation. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
The RUC on the front line. Again, to give this impression, this is criminal. You know, this is nothing to do with politics. And it's hard to say that whenever you have British soldiers on the streets. So they tried now to withdraw the Brits into a sort of a secondary position. And the RUC were then took the primary position. But then the RUC weren't really coming into districts, so therefore we tended to go out of the district, you know, looking for targets. And that's what happened. That's why there was so much activity in Lisburn Road. And plus, then you had the bombing campaign as well. But that's what happened. But it was all part of that policy, authorization. Criminalization and also normalization, trying to get a normal society, you know, inviting groups in and so on, stuff like everything's fine here. Obviously, it wasn't. But the situation in the jails, we didn't really know what to do. No direction came from outside. I don't think outside particularly wanted to tell us what to do because they said well, they're prisoners and we're not really in a position, you know, to tell you what to do. We can guide you and give our advice and so on. But, you know...
Because they're not in there.
You know, you get this nonsense about, you know, again, you know, the godfathers are in control and they're telling these young fellas, you know, what to do. And, you know, these poor prisoners are... Have you even heard, you know, such nonsense as people were ordered on the hunger strike? What nonsense. You can't order somebody. What's the worst thing can happen to you? Yeah. Such nonsense. But anyway, that was, you know... some people do have this idea that, you know, that these people in dark rooms smoking and drinking beer and they're telling, you know, these young kids what to do.
Yeah.
Young kids were the people who, young kids were the ones who carried the war. The young kids were, we were all young. Our average age was 19, and that's the way it was in the Chrome, and that's where it was in the blocks. Average age would have been 19. So we didn't know what was in front of us, but just knew there's no way in the world that we were going to be criminalized. There was no way we were going to wear that prison gear. There was no way we were going to do prison work. And we were very confident that we'd win in the end, you know, full of confidence.
Is it true you want to send messages through fake papers? Is that a thing?
Yes, yes. Communication was very important. I would say the hardest time for any prisoner is isolation. So you crave news from outside, and also you want to keep in contact with outside, and you want to keep in contact even with guys within the wing, within the block, and so on. You just crave contact because you're isolated. You know, you're stuck in this concrete box 24/7. So you want to keep in contact. So yes, we called them, it was different names, but the Irish name was Chalkdarox, also known as Combs. Well, at the start, what we did was we wrote on toilet paper. Now, when you say toilet paper, you're talking about, you possibly wouldn't know this, it was like greaseproof paper, so you could write on it. Yeah. And we would have smuggled in pens. What would we have smuggled in? The refill of a pen. What was quite, the best one we got was actually a Parker refill, because you could grip that. It was handy enough. You could use it. You could grip that. And then we wrote on toilet paper. I mean, cigarette papers were hard to come by.
Is that right?
So, yeah, oh yeah. So like they were precious, but yes, in the end up, that's mostly what we did right on, because then we weren't getting the toilet paper anymore. They used to post in, you know, a couple of roll or a couple of sheets of toilet paper. As I say, we used that, and we even wrote on the Bible as well.
Did you?
Yeah, we wrote on the. You see, all prisoners in every cell, there's a Bible. So we would wrote on the Bible. And we actually used the Bible for cigarette papers as well, to roll cigarettes as well, because it's very hard to come across cigarette papers. But, I mean, coming back, we didn't know what was in front of us, but I say we were committed not to be criminalised. The first person to go on the hunger strike, or sorry, the blanket, was Keir Nugent. He was sentenced in September 76, the first one, and it's what we all said, we're not wearing the gear, and he refused to wear the gear, and that started a blanket protest. By the way, this is May the 5th. This is Bobby Sands' anniversary.
He died on that day, so
it's a privilege to be talking about this today, and it's also a privilege to talk about ex-pupils as well, to be here as well.
That's
so
good.
I'm really pleased to be here.
Jim,
that's Bobby Sands. That's some kind of flag here.
Did you attempt the hunger
strike? Yes and no. It was a difficult decision. It's just, you were part of, you felt committed to it. You felt you couldn't take a back seat. So, I mean, I've been on the protest, 3 or 4 years? And I was always hoping we would never come to hunger strike. In fact, we did everything that's at the disposal, which is very little out of a prisoner, to try and avoid hunger strike. You know, first of all, we were on the blanket, obviously. We were naked in the cell. We just had a blanket around us. We were locked up 24/7. And it could be rough at times with the screws, with the beatings and so on. And then the dark came down after a couple of years, Brenton Hughes. And the dark said, listen, lads, this is going nowhere. You're in a rut. And you know what? He was right. I thought that was enough. And I think most of the lads thought that was enough. And we're a bit annoyed about him because, like, here he's coming down here. We've been on this protest 2 years, quite committed to it. Have more of the gear and so on, you know. And he's saying, it's not good enough. You're going to have to think about this. And maybe you'd even think about coming off the protest, wearing the gear, to go in to the workshops to burn the place. That was his idea. But we could not, we couldn't tolerate that. There was no way we were going to do it. We were committed to the blanket protest. We weren't going to be shifted from that. So then he came up with the other idea, was then we're going to increase the protest.
30 Fusing. Protest?
Well, yes, yeah, no wise, no, yes, yeah. No wise.
You let me have that.
And that's when it got really bad. And that's whenever it got very vicious with screws. And then beatings become a common theme. Another thing that they used was hosing. It was really bad. Now, see, we're talking about hosing. We're talking about the fireman hoses.
Big.
You know, they're big, you know, they knock you off your feet.
Shot you with it naked?
Oh, it was terrible. It was terrible. And then even at night, they would come in and they would use the internal hose at night. That's just the, you know, the fire hose internally. And that would be a smaller one. And we had smashed the hatches and put it through the hatch and the soak yourself. I mean, more times than enough.
Is it true? The wood in the winter, the wood of purposely left the windows open.
What happened in the winter was, and I'm never sure all this how this happened. They were using a chemical. I don't know, the clean or something. I'm not sure what it was. It was a chemical, and it was really bad. It was pungent. Guys were throwing up. Your eyes were watering. You could hardly breathe. We're spraying them. They come in, you know, with the spacesuits. They're coming in spacesuits, and they're spraying this stuff along the walls and in the cell, and we're choking to death. So windows were broken then to get air, and then the word went out that everyone should break the windows, because if we all do it, they can't, you know, pick on individuals. So that was the thing. If we do something, we do it collectively, and word goes around all the blocks, everyone smashed the windows. So the windows were smashed. Yes, we had no window. That was okay, maybe September, October, but then come November, December, it's a different story. Yeah, it was. But I can honestly say the most difficult time I had in the blanket was the winter. It was the winter, because you had no window, you had no windows, right? You had a gap, obviously, but there was no actual glass in the window. And what we did was we put a blanket up on the window and wedged it with a water gallon and the lid of a chamber pot to keep it up. So there you had three blankets. We got three blankets each, so you had to sacrifice one of the blankets. So whoever sacrificed the blanket would sleep alongside the pipes to try and get a bit of heat.
What do you mean sacrifice the blanket?
Well, because you got three blankets, you're in the winter, there's no window.
Well, why sacrifice one? What do you mean?
Because you're trying to keep a bit of heat in the cell, so therefore you put a blanket on.
Right.
So what I'm saying, that means I'm down to two blankets, you know, and it makes a big difference. So we could sleep along the pipe. But here's what happened, and this is what was difficult, really, really difficult. They would change the blankets every now and again, and one particular change during the winter, the blankets they threw in, there was a half decent one, but the other two were like towels. So when you were lying down at night and putting the blankets around you, the two shorter blankets like towels, they kept slipping off. So you were waking up and you were absolutely freezing because it wouldn't cover you. Yeah. It was absolute agony. The thing about the beatings, at least the beatings only lasted for, you know, a few minutes or something, and when it was over. But the winter and the cold just went on and on and on. And sometimes you just wonder, am I going to make it through the morning here? It was the most difficult period I'll never forget it. But thankfully, we come up with this idea and it changed everything. The good blanket you had, what we did, we sewed that up. So it was like a sleeping bag. Right. And then see the two smaller blankets, you were able to put them inside. And because we had like a sleeping bag, they didn't slip off. I can tell you, that changed the ring. Then you were able to, you know, to stick the coal, but only for that genius.
Would you have got many hours sleep, like, every night? Would you have done much sleeping? Yes, you would have.
You know, you see, but there was some really bad periods you went through with what we call them screws, prison officers, where they would come in and they would bang the cell doors with the battens. They would turn lights on. And also the biggest thing of them all was the hosing. They'll come in and
want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously, your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
At night, and also we threw the pee out the door. So every night, say about 10 o'clock or so, the word, the OC, which OC is the officer in command, we shout out word flocky and walk up, means throw the pee out the door, and we'd all throw it out, right? But then what would happen is, at some stage, probably in the early hours of the morning or something, the screws would come in with squeegees, and they would start squeegeeing it back in again. So you could be lying sleeping, right? Mm-hmm. Next thing is a wave coming back in to your cell with all the pee. For a long time, I was in the bottom cell. And by the time they squeegeed that down to the bottom cell, it was a tidal wave. And then I would have got it more times than enough. Other guys wouldn't have got it so much because, you know, when they were squeezing the pee in the cells, you were pushing it back out again. So they still had to work. But the thing was, whenever I was, because I was in the bottom cell, they said, right, well, it's only him, right? So they wanted to get something done, you know. They wanted to take their venom out, you know, on something, you know. Yeah. So quite regularly, they would have farted in the R cell. And, you know, we had to put it out again. But then when they were coming down to do, they had to do a security button, which is outside at the bottom of the wing. They would have took the squeegee and just did it again or something, you know. So, I mean, that you would have lost sleep over that. See, but, of course, you could sleep during the day, you know. So, you know, it was just disruptive. You
couldn't really settle or, like, at
any point. No, you were sort of on your guard. You were sort of on your guard. Especially, like, see, when you're sleeping and something like that happens, it's not easy. It really threw, because you're all over the place.
It's like, was a really bad stink, like obviously.
Yeah, I think you got used to it. You know, I mean, this is annoying. When it started, when we escalated the protest, you thought, there's no way the human body can take this. There's going to be diseases. People are going to be sick. And, you know, and you like that because then you're saying it no longer had that sense of permanence, which the protest had before that, you know, before the dark came. You said, well, this should be a conclusion here. The body just adapts. It just adapts. What happens? Just get dirty, end of story. Yeah. You know, we were surprised by this. But what I'm saying was, we did everything we could. We did everything we could to avoid hunger strike because it was always hanging there. It was always in the air. And you didn't want to do that, obviously, because you had a fair idea. If we're going on hunger strike, people are going to lose their lives. With nothing left. We had exhausted everything that was at our disposal. We had absolutely nothing left. Well, there was also talks going on the outside, particularly Cardinal O'Fake. And times it was looking good.
There's people able to break out, wasn't there, as well?
That came later. That came after. And that's another story. I'll come to that as well. But the thing was, we had nothing and we weren't giving up. So it was hunger strike. So they called for volunteers for the hunger strike. Yes, I put my name down. We just hoped for the best. You felt, you know, this is my protest as well. You can't take a back seat. And that was it. So I put my name down. And what happened then was they selected 7 to go on the hunger strike. The dark led it. And it was 7 was symbolic because it was 7 people signed a proclamation, you see. And it took them a good geographical spread as well. Raymond Courtney went up in Derry. Tommy McKerney would have been Tyrone. Sean McKenna would have been South Armagh. The Dark would have been Belfast. Leo Green would have been Armagh, North Armagh, Lurgan, and so on. So it was, and that would have been a good geographical spread. Hunger strike didn't work out the way we thought it would have. We didn't. I mean, we thought that would have been it. That would have been the conclusion. We would have got our demands. And because we never thought of not winning, by the way. It was never there. But what happened was Sean McKenna was about to die. And there was talk that, listen, Dark, why would you let him die? Because there's a possibility here. There's a document here saying you're going to get some of the things. You're not going to get everything, but you get some of the things that you want.
Margaret Thatcher, she was the one that was it, was Maggie Thatcher?
She wouldn't call it off. That was the one that came after.
Maggie Thatcher was in it. Yeah, she was the Prime Minister.
She wasn't given, like, she was saying no.
Oh, absolutely. I honestly think, had there been another Prime Minister at the time, I don't think this would have happened. I think they would have negotiated. I think it would have been compromises. I honestly think that she always felt she had to prove herself, that she had to be stronger and better than all the men around her. And that's why she treated them as well, you know, because I know she was advised. You're hearing all these things now. She was advised, listen, negotiate, you know, compromise, there's a way around this, making the IRA stronger, they're out in the streets, the IRAs, this is happening there, they're going from strength to strength and so on, support's increasing, you know. She just didn't listen to anyone. She took it personal. She took it personal. And then the big shock for her as well was Bobby Sands' election.
MP,
Bobby Sands was
elected.
Bobby Sands was elected for Fermanagh, South Tyrone, April. He was elected MP. Frank McManus, I think it was the MP, died of a heart attack. And then some, again, good strategy. The Republican Minister said, we'll put Bobby Sands up. We were sort of confident, you know.
Do you know Bobby personally?
Yeah, I knew Bobby personally, yeah. I was in the ring with him, you know. And then every blanket man will tell you this, and Pat Sheehan actually mentioned this at the unveiling of Bobby's statue yesterday. I'll never forget this. That day when the word was coming in of the result of the election, we had small radios. Most of the wings, we had one radio in every wing. So someone was able to listen to the news, right? So Crystal said to call me, that size there. I still have it, actually. I have it framed in the house. I can't hang on to it because I knew it was history. So the word came from the right round the blocks, you'll see. We're going to, the result coming in about 5 o'clock. If he's winning here, no cheering. Nobody has to cheer, because if we start cheering, then they will know we have radios. And next thing, they'll tear this place apart to get the radio, right?
Right.
I'll never forget it. Gino getting up the door and giving the result. Boo, boo, Bobby. That means, you know, Bobby won. Place just erupted.
Did it?
We couldn't contain it. Couldn't contain it. Well, just place went mad, screaming, shouting, banging doors. I'm sure crying too. Absolutely brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. It was one of the best days of my life. One of the best days of my life. Because we knew we had support, but that was confirming that we had brilliant support. Great for the people from Anna South Tyrone. And we knew it just wasn't there. It was all over. And also, we sort of we believed and hoped that would save his life. That would have saved his life. That was the big thing. That's going to save Bobby's life. Unfortunately.
Was Bobby in, was he inside whenever he got elected?
He was on hunger strike. He was on hunger strike. Yeah, he was on hunger strike. He was. He was. He must have been about 40 days or so on hunger strike at that stage.
What age was Bobby when he died?
27.
Yeah, 27. Yeah, 27.
So I can't picture, yeah. Like a picture putting myself.
But he was a good and you know, and you know, see, here's the thing, Bob. Here's the thing. That changed everything. That blew criminalisation out of the water. They were finished. They were finished, you know. And really, if she had any sense, she would have compromised at that stage, you know. And of course, that was the makings of Sinn Féin as well, because that set Sinn Féin up for electoral politics now, and eventually ended the armed conflict. So it was historic. It was historic. Didn't realise at the time how historic it was, but it was historic. And then, of course, the 10 lads as well.
Yeah.
You know.
Is that a man? I think,
you know, it got us support throughout the world. People admired the Republican movement. People saying, hold on, see if they're criminals. Why on earth are they dying? That's not the mentality of a criminal.
I was watching a documentary, and it was Joe McDonald's daughter was over in America.
Bernadette, yeah.
On a talk show, yeah. To pretend to voice it out to the American public.
That's right.
Trying to get support back.
That's
as well.
Right, that was Bernadette.
But it's crazy. Like, it's hard.
I was with Joe.
Did you know Dolores Price?
No. Didn't know Dolores.
See the did they ever see any documentaries on them where like they were getting force fed when they were trying to?
That's right. I know Jerry. Jerry was force fed.
Jerry Kelly.
Jerry was with them. Yeah, that's right. Something like.
Well, they put a tube down your throat and put food.
They put a clamp in your mouth. Yeah, and then it actually that's how Michael Gahan died. Because they punctured his lung when they were putting the tube down. And then he died.
Are they allowed to do it? No, should you be allowed to do it?
Well, they were at the time. I mean, as you know, they did that probably with the suffragettes way back in 1914. But anyway.
It's crazy.
So we had the situation where the 10 lads died. I never for 1 minute believed there was going to be 10 people. I knew Bob, Bobby was going to die. Because of the first hunger strike, they probably thought, you know, the Brits would have thought, oh, it's brinkmanship here. they're not prepared to die. They're only prepared to take it so far, and then they're going to come off it, right? So it's bring my ship. So Bobby knew that he had to die.
Jesus Christ.
So it was like, so that was the talk dead man walking. But here's the thing as well. There was plenty of opportunities to end this. See, between the hunger strikes, because there was, they did sort of way make promises, and that was open for negotiation.
Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
And what they did was, whenever the hunger strike ended, they recognised Bobby as the OC, and Bobby was ferried about all the blocks, all the wings, went in and interviewed. They recognised our structures. So Bobby's going in talking to the OCs, this is what's happening. And they were ferrying people out to the hospital to have meetings. So there was a recognition of the structure. And therefore, it seemed as if there was a willingness on their behalf to try and come to some compromise. And Bobby would have been back and forward to the governor, who was Hilditch at the time. But then it turned very sour. It just turned. Around about Christmas, it turned completely.
Why do you think it turned sour? Do you know now?
Because they smelt blood. Yeah. I'm talking about the British government. They smelt blood. They thought they've nowhere to go. They played their last card. What else can they do? They're not prepared to die. They can lie in their blanket for the next 10, 20 years, all the better. Because then that means they're not getting out. They're losing their remission. Happy days. Let them rot. And they says, you know, they probably say, it'll probably happen. It'll peter out. So just let them. And all the better, they say to themselves. So, you know, they'll be defeated. Happy days, right? They just couldn't understand the commitment to it. We were like
the spirit of one Irish man.
You know, it was, we were like in a bubble, you know, and it was total commitment. You know, there was no way we were ever going to give in. Now, I don't even think outside, the IRA outside could understand that. You know, you had to be in that situation, because basically the IRA was saying, listen, get something, get a compromise and get it over with.
Yeah.
And that was on Bobby's shoulders, because he was OC. So Bobby was going back and forward to this governor to try and get something. I think he's in the case. See if they had to give us our clothes. It would have ended. I think it would have ended, because that would have been enough for us then to make the next move. Well, we're never giving up, you know, like burning the workshops or something would have came next. But it would have ended the protest, and there'd be no need for a hunger strike. But they wouldn't give anything at all. What actually happened? Again, because we were told, try and get something. So what we did, the sort of, again, a willingness to negotiate, to compromise, two wings come off the protest. The No Wash protest. Two wings. Bobby's wing and our wing. And a number of the lads present themselves for work. Now, when we say work, it was education and maintaining the wing, which we do anyway. Right? So that was agreed, and we were moved into clean wings, furnished wings, and so on. Right? And the lads presented themselves to be orderlies in the wing and to go for education, and their parents come up, their families come up and left them in clothes and all. But the families were told, no, not a chance. They're not getting their clothes. And the governor said, see, if you're presenting yourself for work, then you move in the conforming blocks. So basically, it was like as if Bobby almost was going to this governor, you know, with cap in hand, you know, basically pleading for it, which wasn't the case, you know, but that's the way we felt at the time. Listen, there's no way. There's no way we're going begging for something which is ours. We're not giving up here. The hell with
him. He felt like he's had the right.
Yeah, area, of course. Yeah, absolutely. You're giving us our rights. You know, that's what it is. You're giving us what we're entitled to.
Yeah.
You know, we're not begging for anything. No way. Nor are we giving in. So we smashed the place up then. that was it. And you know what? It was another good day. It was brilliant because I hated the thought of him going back and forward to governor and, you know, will you do this and do that? Compromise. Get into it again. So we smashed the place up. Brilliant. Felt good again. Yes, we're back on. But I knew it was going to be a hunger strike. You knew that was it. But you knew all that negotiation, which was going nowhere, was over. And you almost felt like you were getting your dignity back as well.
Yeah.
It was over. So I smashed the place up. Great. Then, of course, the riots war comes in, which wasn't so great. And we got battered. They trailed us across. That was one of the worst wing shifts ever. They trailed us across from one side of the wing to across the circle. And there was a gauntlet. Actually, it's one of them films. I think it was Hunger. You'll see it. They're the big shields. They're in the rack here and they're banging the shields and you're running through the gauntlet and you're getting battered as you run through.
Aye, they're all standing.
They're all standing. Like a tunnel and you're going through like an old tunnel. That was it. That was it. And then we threw us in cells on the other side. There was no windows, no mattresses, no blankets, nothing. And it was January and it was freezing and they just left us there all night. It was one of the longest nights ever. And you had to keep walking because if you sat down, you'd get freeze. Yeah. And there was pools because they were cleaning it. It was filled with water because they had been in hosing it. And then the next day, I was never so glad to see a blanket coming in. But we only got the blanket. Next thing, he moved us again. They moved us up to H6. And we got another battering up there as well. It was terrible. It was terrible. But the thing was, we were back at it again.
Yeah.
And you're happy. And so we moved the two wings up. Bobby's wing and our wing. And Bobby's just across. We're able to shout across to them. You know, which was good, and Bickernall was there as well. It was good, and you knew Bob. I said, knew Bobby. Big McFarlane. He died there recently as well. He was OC during the hunger strikes. He was the OC. Yeah. So, I just want to say this.
Yes, go ahead.
There was every opportunity to resolve the situation. Many an opportunity present themselves with the talks, with the negotiations. They would never do it. They refused to do it. And again, I think a lot of that was because of the type of personality Maggie Thatcher had. It changed the course of Irish history. That woman didn't realise what she was doing. She changed the course of Irish history.
Like, you're in them cells. You're also trying to, like, educate yourselves and do things. And it's not as if you're just sitting there rotting away. You're trying to keep your mind.
Yeah, well, as best you could. You know, we were locked up 24/7.
Yeah.
We were denied of all stimulation. This is the thing, but you had nothing.
See,
there
was
no books, nothing. It was just doing
like
a box.
Is it like solitary where you're just took away from everything and you have no communication? Like, that would be, I can only imagine it, but I'm sure it would be tormenting because it's hard. Like,
you always wanted to be with your comrades because it made a difference.
Having a better company.
But look, we didn't get everything we wanted. And personally, I was a bit down after that. I mean, as I said, I was always possibly a bit naive on it too, you know. I was always so optimistic that we're going to get our political status, we're going to have our big day and so on. And it's something we always talked about, and we're going to organise this, that and the other. And it didn't work out the way you wanted or hoped and prayed for. It didn't work out like that. And then, of course, there's 10 lads dead, lads who you knew and had been spent years with them, you know, on the blanket and shared everything with them as well. And they were gone, you know.
Would you have been allowed to go to their funeral?
No.
No?
No, the guys, the parents, had parents died, brothers, sisters, and they didn't get out of the funeral either.
No way. So you end up...
It's the harshest fucking living environment you can think of is what they were in.
So you end up breaking out of that?
Well, what happened was, so hunger strike ended, we got our clothes in, and that changed things, you know, but there's still no work, and therefore we're still on a protest for about another year, okay? And then the decision was taken, this is going nowhere, right? We're going to have to come off this. But things were organized in advance. What they call a task force. Now, they've got the word task force from the Malvinas / Falklands back in 82 when the Argentinians went into Malvinas and took it over because it's right beside them. And then Thatcher again.
The British.
She sent a task force to the Malvinas. So it was the same time we sent a task force into the conformist blocks, picked out guys and says, go in, right, and get the loyalists locked up. Get them to protest. And if they don't, then we're getting into them. And of course, the loyalists, you know, seeing these fucking madmen who have been locked up for 5 years and so on, you know, coming and here they are now, they're nuts, these guys, right? Which we were prepared to do whatever we had to do,
yeah.
Right? And they knew that. So we're told, you're locking up. And not only are you locking up, you're smashing up the cell and you're doing this, that, and that. So then they went to protest. So then they moved the loyalists out to non-conforming blocks, right? So then we said we would conform, which we weren't like, and then they moved us into the blocks. So therefore, we had segregation. We had segregation. So that was another one then. So we got segregation because we put the loyalists on a lockup, on a protest, right? So it's segregation with our own wings, right? Then the next thing we were going to do was going to burn the workshops. So it's going to be no work. I was an orderly. That's fine. That was you maintaining the place. But I have to say, it really did annoy me whenever guys were being called, you know, for the workshops. I'm going, why are we not burning these workshops? What is going on here? And then the people like who I was, you know, people like Beck McFarlane, who was also an orderly, would have been making them tea, Scrooge tea, and would have been doing their crosswords. And I still had a lot of animosity towards prison officers because of what we went through. Because, yeah. I mean, there were serious beatings and so on. I still had animosity, and I just couldn't break that, you know?
Yeah.
Whereas Beck and another, you know, Cormac McGart and Bobby Story and all of their, you know, what about you, Bob? And, you know, where were you last night and so on? I was really annoyed. I said, what's happening here with the lads? You know?
No, it didn't make sense for you.
It didn't make sense. It didn't make sense. And I was saying, why are we not burning these workshops?
Yeah.
What's happening? You know? Until a certain person came into my cell and said, listen, do you want to go and escape?
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Do you want to go to escape?
Sounds like a plan.
And then a ring fell into place. What they were doing, sorry, because I wasn't part of that, you know, I had a role obviously in the escape. They were conditioning the screws. They were conditioning them to give them the impression.
Softening them down
exactly.
A wee bit.
Yeah. And that we had softened, you know, that this is all. Looking at it, everything's over. It's all over. You know, we're just going to do our time and get out. And we want to make it as easy as possible. And look, you know, we're walking about the wings here. And, you know, there's no danger. Nothing's happening. Nobody's getting beaten up. You know, there's no vengeance taking place. You know, it was conditioning. Because in order for that escape to work, there's, you know, it's a lot of grills and so on you had to go through. You had to have the freedom to walk about the jail. You had to go up the grill and a screw would just open the grill and let you through. These were the orderlies, you know, were doing this, right? I would have had the freedom as well because I was an orderly. But the, you know, particularly key men had to have freedom. So Beck McFarlane would have had to run the jail. Bobby Story sort of way would have had to run the jail, maybe not so much as Beck. Brendan Mead would have had it. Tony McAllister would have had. In other words, you had the guys there who could go into all those areas, like it's called the circle. That's where the control room is. That's where most of the screws are. So they were in there working in there.
Kind of gaining their trust a wee bit.
You know, and you even have to get outside the block and go to the gates and so on, and you know, sweep up there and so on. They had to get used to you being in all them areas, being in forced name bases, and that's what happened. That was the conditioning, which was driving me mad, and I didn't know it was conditioning because of all
you
this.
Just didn't understand.
I didn't get it. And of course, it was only a small group. They couldn't, obviously couldn't tell because it had to be kept tight.
Yeah.
And the only reason you were told anyway was if you had a role, you're going to escape and you had a role. This is what you have, this is what you'll be doing, so on. So another great experience, one of the best experiences again, so I'll never ever forget it, especially because you heard me already saying about we wanted our big day with political status and, you know, when we get their clothes, we'd come in and we'd be celebrating and so on. We didn't get that day. We got it on the escape. That was the big day that we didn't get. That was the victory that we didn't get. It was absolutely fantastic. Professional, everything done exactly the way it was supposed to be done until we got to the tally lodge. Military precision, it was brilliant. Just bang, we took that whole block on with a couple of minutes. We had all them screws under our command.
So talk us through that day of the escape. So how many of us was there?
Escaped?
Yeah.
39, wasn't it? 39.
Right, so yeah. The morning of the escape, what's come through your head? Like, you're going
Really nervous, really up to 100. Everyone was the same. And, of course, things weren't going, you know, the way that they should be going, you know, possibly because we were so tense. And because we were so tense, and by the way, only those who were on the escape were aware of the escape, plus what we called a rear guard. Now, the rear guard were those who were picked to hold on to the block when we had gone to give us time. So those guys are, who weren't on the escape but did the rear guard. So the rear guard and the escapees had an away. So, I mean, actually...
Because you probably would have got people there who weren't on the escape wanting to probably escape too, but they couldn't, if you know what I mean.
It was an IRA escape.
Yeah.
In the story.
Did you walk out the front door?
More or less. I mean, what happened was, we needed guns from the circle. They had to have guns in the circle. So there was five key people went into the circle, and they knew all the areas to go. You know, one to go into what's called the mess, one to go into the principal officer's room, one to go into the medical room, one to go into the big one was the security room. That was the big one, because that's where, you know, the buttons and so on, the alarms and so on. That had to go first. That was the first thing had to go. So the key was the bumper. I was with Bobby. We were waiting on the call coming from Tony McAllister, I think it was, or no, Beck, for the bumper. That was a cue for everyone to get in their positions. Where's the bumper there? They would shout over, I was in C wing, they would shout over to A and B wing first. Is the bumper there? Knowing the bumper wasn't there. But in other words, lads, positions, get in your positions. Then they shout down to our wing, bring the bumper out. Bobby got the bumper. But I remember the time factor. I don't know. I was washing the shirt, and he was washing the shirt, because I had to stay close to the screw who was on the grill. So the best thing to do was wash the shirt, and Bobby's obviously waiting on the bumper shirt. But it went on. It seemed forever. I remember saying to Bobby, I don't know how many times I washed the shirt, and I said, I'm sure that screw, something, the nose or something going on here. I was 20 minutes washing the shirt, and he was the same. I said, Bobby, what's happening here? He said, see if it doesn't start soon. He said, it's not going to happen. And then he says, and we're trying to reassure each other. He says, can you see this flipping short, you know, down his belt? I said, no. I says, Bobby, you wouldn't even see a rocket launcher was down your belt. I said, I'm good. Can you see this hammer? Right? And he says, no.
Did you have a hammer on you?
Well, yeah, just in case. I mean, it's something I didn't want to use. It was like an emergency backup, because what the idea was, there was people allocated to jump screws. Because most of the guys were taking a circle all from our wing, bar one. The only one wasn't from our wing was Jerry Kelly. Brandy, me, Tony McAllister, Beck and Bobby were all our wing. So there was a bit of a shortage in our wing for screws. So I had to take a screw on my own, right? But you didn't want to make it equal. You want to make sure there was no mistakes here, and you were putting the screw down because you didn't want them hitting the alarm. So I was chuffed that they picked me, you know, just. But then I found out later on they had a standby, they had a backup just in case I didn't do it. There was somebody else. They didn't tell me at the time. But anyway, so shout comes, Bobby brings the bumper in. Once he brings the bumper in, they're making sure the screws are all in the right place. And then, bang, they move in their positions and hold them all up, okay? And the person who was doing the control room would have got John Adams, who was a screw. Was that right, John?
And they're taking all their guns off him, it's basically.
They didn't have guns.
Oh, they didn't? No.
The so didn't know. Get on the floor. Get on the floor, right? John Adams had got on the floor then, right? And then word came, you know, right away word came for us. It was like, you know, it was like a ripple, in fact. You know, if you drop a pebble into the water and you see the ripples, that's where it went. So circle went, then in between the grills went, then the wings went, just bang, bang, bang.
Like right? A domino effect?
Down, that's it. Down you go. So the whole place within a couple of minutes was under our control. And then we took the keys of the screws, put pillowcases over their head so they couldn't see exactly what was going on. And like I have to say, and this is another thing I'm very proud of too, there was no violence. It was just enough force to get them on the ground and get them to do what they were told. Minimum force. There was no repercussions because of what had went beforehand and the blanket protest, the brutality and so on. Some of them were real bad boys too.
Yeah, you could have been cruel, but you yes, chose
to not. Yes, but this is not, we just want to escape, end of story. That's all we want to do, escape, end of story. So where we tied them up, so on pillowcases overhead, and got everything ready to go. Next thing, what happened, there was a screw was in the toilet, and they forgot about him. He was in all the different rooms, POs, mess, medical. And he come out, so he come out of the toilet, right? And he nearly died. And what happened was the person who was guarding the control room, John Adams, turned and saw him. And when he turned, John Adams made a dive for the alarm. So this person then shot him. And he shot him. And right away, we got the medic in right away to look after John Adams, could put him on a mattress and so on, you know. And then next thing, the grub lorry come in. This is what we're going to escape in. So the grub lorry come in. It was late. By the way, this is the problem. It was late coming. It come in, and then the rear guard took over. Then they took over our positions. They were looking after the screws who were all tied up and so on. And they got on the front gate as well because they had to have a screws. Guy dressed up as a screw went on the front gate. So as when anyone's passing, they'll see a screw at the gate. So all them positions that you had to fill were filled by the rear guard. We all got into the lorry, and we headed down through different gates. It's like the... You know those Russian dolls, you know, like one inside the other. That's the way the phases work. You get out through the block, then you go through a phase, then you go through another phase, then you go down. It's just gate after gate and wall after wall. But we got straight through, and we had people, you know, we were stopped at gates and we had to pull somebody, and we had people. So we would pull the screw in, if need be, and somebody who was already dressed as a screw would go and take over the gate, so as there'd be nobody missing from that area. The problem was...
well thought out, like, and well brilliant.
Problem was the tally lodge... It was the timing. We hit it whenever the screws were going off and coming on. So when they took over the tally lodge, the rest of us remained inside the lorry. And what happened was it was just too many. They were coming in both ends. And you know what? It was hard to convince them that it was an escape. You know, as they were coming in, they were saying, right, get on the floor.
Get on the floor. All right, we're getting out here.
On the floor. Right, so that was a difficulty as well. But they end up... There was that many screws coming from both ends. It was just couldn't cope anymore. They were laying on top of each other and they were hitting the alarms.
Yeah.
And the word was coming from the ECR, that's the emergency control room, the main one. What are you playing at down there? Stop hitting them alarms. Because they didn't believe there was an escape going on either. So, and then when we were trying to get out, the screws could see what was happening. They recognised one of the prisoners and they blocked the main gate, the tally gate, with cars. And Bobby came out. I said, right, lads, come on, you won't have to get out. I was at the back, beside, you know, the back door. I was one of the first to jump out. And he's bringing us into the tally lodge because a Brit was hanging out of the sensory box. We were waiting on him opening up on us, right? So we thought it was safer if someone was went into the tally lodge itself. But it was bedlam. And next thing they were trying to, it was hand-to-hand fighting in the tally lodge, right? But what happened was the tailgate, you were climbing over it. But because there were so many climbing out, I think it bust and it opened up. And next thing you'd see all the lads spilling out. And the screws couldn't believe there's so many. They thought there was only about half a dozen of us.
Was all you in that van?
About 40 people. 40?
All except the guys who went in, about six went in the tally lodge. Yeah, we're all in the back. It's a big, big lorry. So all start piling out. And the screws couldn't believe it. So then Bobby says, right, run out the gate. So we're running out the gate and the screws were standing there with batons. The screws, I said, we just run through them, right? But I said to myself... You know, there was no plan B. I could see just a field in front of me, and you still weren't outside the camp. You were outside the jail, but still within a camp because it's a military camp and there's barbed wire and walls and so on around that again. And there's obviously Brits and all in the sentry boxes. And I said, there's no way I'm running over that field and over that barbed wire because you're going to get shot. I saw a car and I went for a car. He got away, couldn't get it open. And then there was another car, Toyota Celica, and Brendy Mead was in that, and I bounced in with Brendy. Barry Art got in it, Jimmy Burns, Jimmy Donnelly, Paul Kane, we were all in the car. Brendy couldn't get it started. It was like one of them Hitchcock films, the screws all around, smashing at the windows. And one of them had a short as well. Actually, one of our shorts, and it wouldn't work. He was trying to shoot, trying to fire in.
He
was trying to fire it, and it wouldn't work, and he just threw it and smashed the window. Thankfully, Brendy got the car going, and away we went. And I said, well, we're the only ones escaping because there's no way them guys are going to make it over that field. And, you know, because the Brit was going to obviously going to shoot them. Yeah, exactly. There's not a chance. And away we went. But you could see as we were driving along, the Brits and the sentry boxes, and you were just waiting them opening up on us. I thought it was an absolute super. I couldn't understand why he didn't fire.
Did no one get shot?
Harry Murray got shot by one of the Brits in the sentry box when he's going over the field. But so, as I said, I was waiting to get blown all over the road. And then what happened, it was about half a mile, we drove up along the side, and then you're getting out of the camp, and that's what the Brits would be on the last gate, and also screws. But a car came flying in front of us, and, you know, flashing the lights and bumping the horn. And then they could see our car, but they still didn't know what was going on. And Brendy just put the boot to the board, and that Brit just dived and closed that flipping last gate. He closed it, and we just
rammed it.
We smashed into it, right? I thought, you know, God, we're going to get mangled here, right? And probably shot. It just did enough to wedge the gate open. And I bounced out of the car right away. Through the, you know, the window was out, you know, the windscreen was bust. I dived out through the front window, over the bonnet, and got out through the gate. And I looked round and had the car surrounded. And I said, I'm the only one escaping here. So... I didn't want to go down Blair's Road because the sentry box could see right down it, as I really would have liked one down Blair somewhere. So I went run down the Halftown Road. But they come after me. The Brit and a couple of screws come after me, right? And then the Brit's starting to scream, you know, halt or I shoot. And you just knew. He almost got a sense he didn't want to shoot, you know, just the way he was screaming it, you know, getting excited and tense, you know. Of course, he did shoot.
Oh, did he shoot at
you? Oh, he did, yeah. I start zigzagging, right? And he fired a shot, right? And then I could see further down the road, there was a road, they call it the Bog Road, going to the left. I didn't really want to go to the left, but I just knew I had to go around there because you were covered then. If you get around there, you're gonna survive.
Get away, right? From getting shot at.
Yeah, because then he fired another shot, and he fired a second shot. And I said, see, the next one. It's going to hit you. Right. You know, it's not going to be third time lucky here, right? So thank God, I just got round the corner and you're flipping happy days, you know, at least you're not going to get shot here. Then I ran over, but I knew, see, when I got round and started running a wee bit, I knew I was going back down into the camp. I was actually coming right back down into the camp. And there was a sentry box down there as well on the Bog Road because the visiting area was there. That's how you're going to do the visits. So I said, I ran over the field to get into the field, but the field was completely upturned. You know, there's no way you could have run through that field. No way. And see, by the time I did that, got into the field and was going to get out again, the Brit was on top of me.
Was he?
Oh, he was on top of me. He fucking kept running. And he had the gun, you know, in my head.
So what happens there? Did you get caught?
I got caught there and then, yeah.
I just broke out and never...
No, the rest of them got away. No, 19... There was 19 got clean away, and 19 ended up getting caught.
So see the 19 that got away?
Yeah.
But did they ever serve time in jail again?
Not them all. Some of them did. Some of them never did. Tony McAllister never did. So Barry Art, who was in the car with me, never did. He ended up in America. You know what happened? See, when I went round the left,
they went
the right. And Barry Art, to say he got away, Brendan Mead, Paul Keane, Jimmy Burns, although they were eventually caught.
You know what you should have done? You should have run to the right.
You know what it was? I just wanted to get out of the road. Oh, I said, no, but I never went the right. They'd have followed me. That's the thing.
So you had to take over the team, man.
Yeah, so I took them away. I took them away. That's what happened.
Them 20 boys.
But I have to say,
the 19 that got away, basically.
It was another great day. It was a day, the victory day that we didn't have. You know, we were shattered. You were caught. Mates and all got away. Happy days. But it was a fantastic operation, and they were so confident. You know, we have the IRA under control in this prison now. You know, they're making me tea and doing crosswords. You know, they're settled. They're no danger. Were they wrong? Were they wrong? But you know, you heard me talking earlier on about burning the workshops. That was the workshops finished. That was work finished. There's no way we can let them out the workshops, because what was happening as well was, at the workshops you were meeting guys from other blocks, so. Every couple of weeks, you got a big search. So what you could do then, see things that you needed, like guns and so on. See if you got a search. If you were due a search, you could bring the guns out and give them to somebody in another block who had just had a search and wouldn't make it one for a while.
Yep,
and then, you know, when their time comes near, they could shift them guns around again. So you could shift stuff about the camp. It was great for communication. The workshops were really good. And that's why they didn't want to burn your wives. They wanted not burning them. Because it was good for communication. It was good for moving things about. And they realise that this is what's happening here. These guys here, we need to try and isolate them now.
See, when you get caught, then you get brought in. What was the repercussions? Because obviously, they would have tried to make an example or something like this. Because obviously, he's trying to get away.
There was really, really, really bad beatings.
Yeah.
Oh, they did. But when I was lucky, I was very lucky because I was caught at the other end of the camp, not down where, you know, all the action was.
Yeah.
And a governor actually, and I did get a bit of a head, not much. A governor actually came and went with the screws to ensure that they weren't going to touch me. He actually came with me. And you know, the way to get back into camp was through the tally lodge. And he says, no, you're not going through the tally lodge. There's another tally lodge, you know, at the political status end where the cages are, the compounds are. He insisted, he told the driver, go through that end. You're not going through that end. Because he knew they'd have trailed me out and beat the crap clean out of me. So I was very lucky with that governor watched over me. Because what happened was the screws actually mutinied. They just went back. You know, when they were kicking people unconscious, it was really bad.
They probably feel like embarrassed.
Of course they were embarrassed. You know what I mean? Of course they were embarrassed, humiliated. Absolutely. The whole place was, of course they were. Yeah. Of course they were. We did take them to court over that, and there was a lot of compensation paid out to us over that, you know, because there was lots of evidence. You know, not that that mattered. The thing is, we wanted no one. Yes, this is what they did. This is what they did. But anyway, we were on a high. As I said, it was great. They put us on what's called the Red Book then for a long time after that. We'd never settled. You'd be on the move all the time. You know, every week to 2 weeks, they move you from one block to another. Constant movement, you know, disruptive. And then, you know, sometimes even do it 5 or 6 days, they would move so it wouldn't be too predictable. And, you know, they'd be checking your cell constantly. The thing about it is, they could never sustain anything like that. They could never sustain. They always got fed up. You know, we were getting the harassment with doors banging, messing about with food, all them things, parcels, all those things happened, you know. You were victimized, but they could never sustain that. After a while, they got fed up, you know. Yeah. And then things just, you know, just same as everybody else.
It's hard to break your spirit.
Well, it was never going to work. And then actually what happened, and the lads would pull them, and they knew who was doing it with pull them, and saying, you do it to one of us, you do it to all of us. You know, end of story. You know, they knew that too. But, I mean, at the end of the day, we got everything we wanted. We run the wings ourselves. We didn't wear the prison gear. We didn't do prison work. We used our time well, educating ourselves, politicizing ourselves, you know, and then better sport and so on, better crack, music and so on. It was the worst days and the best days. I think that's the best way to explain it.
Is it true you were allowed, like, a budgie? Into you?
No, I don't. not during my time. They were allowed in the compounds, in the cages. They did have budgies. They had birds. They did. We didn't. In a way, we were supposed to be criminals, you know.
I seen a podcast where Johnny Adair was on, and he says,
the loyalists were fucking. They were.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together, because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
We're able to get access.
Possibly they did. Well, I've never came across
this. He brought a dog.
This was in the 90s. Yeah, but things did change. Even get better, and eventually there was no lockups, so they completely done away with them. But that was after my time. I got out in 1984.
Johnny Adair actually says about the hunger strikers, even though he despises Catholics, that he respects hunger strikers for staring death in the face. Like, you know, you're going to die in a couple of days. They're still, the brave men, what they've done, like, so fair play to them.
They have everybody's respect,
they do,
because that's something no human can really imagine actually doing it. It's actually sacrificing your life.
I would imagine they're always hoping that there was going to be a breakthrough. But another big factor in the hunger strike, yes, it was the whole conflict, the whole struggle was in the basket. All our eggs were basically in the basket, and you couldn't lose. You couldn't lose. And the lads were carrying that weight on their shoulders. There's no way we could have lost that. Right? They had to go through it. And there's also that bond with us as well, don't let the lads down.
Yeah.
And we were in contact with them. They would send down messages and write chalk the rocks and so on. And it was always the same thing. Tell the lads we're not letting them down. tell the lads everything's okay. Tell the lads you can depend on. That was constant.
See, a hunger strike, was it water and bread, or was it just...
No, just water. Just water, water and salt. Water and salt. And that was difficult too, because it was like a conveyor belt. I mean, Bobby led it, and then you had Frank Hughes, and you had Raymond and Patsy. So Bobby would have been 2 weeks, I think, in front of Frank, and then Frank would have been probably a week or 2 weeks in front of Raymond and so on.
So
done
every 2 weeks?
So, you know, Frank could see what it was going to be like, you know, next week or the fortnight, and Raymond could see what it was going to be like, you know, a few weeks and weeks. And then you see when they died, and then Joe took over, right? He could see it, and people come to mind, they could see where they were going to be in so many weeks' time by those who were in front
of
them.
That'd be scary.
And not only that, when they're in the cell, and, you know, they move up the hospital, when they're in the cell, they can also hear them dying. And that was very difficult as well, because, you know, there's times where they were taking fits and so on, and then you have the relatives, and then you hear the crying, and then you hear the trolley being wheeled in, and obviously the body going in the trolley, and then the trolley being wheeled out, and they are saying, this is all in front of me. So they could hear, they could hear the whole thing, you know. So it must have been really, really traumatic.
Yeah,
you know.
And you see the some of the, like when I was watching 66 Days and it shows you Bobby Sands what he was writing and all on his last days. Yeah. Like it's emotional.
Did you,
like,
do you talk Irish?
Of course. Standing on the
threshold. Yeah, well, yes, we communicate in Irish. Yeah,
we did.
We communicate in Irish, so the schools wouldn't know, what we were saying. And then it was also from block to block we would shout. You call it a scourger. It's a shouter. The scourger would shout across the other block or the other wing. We did that all the time. You know, the regular thing was every night once the screws left at 8:30, but they just leave a night guard then. Then that's when the blocks became alive. And somebody would scourge across the other wing. You know, Cotter Harlan knew what happened today, you know. And then the other wing would cross, you know, Will Trefar, three people, and so on, and go down, a couple of go down and so on. They would give you all, you know, the list of casualties and so on. That would happen. And the same again with when you're shouting from H5 over to H4, they would tell you the casualties, so you would know, you know, what was happening and what wing shifts. Especially wing shifts. Wing shifts were a nightmare. That was an excuse for them for a beating. You felt safe when the door was shut. See, once you opened that door, you didn't know what was going to happen. So wing shifts in particular, you're moving from one wing. Every couple of weeks, they would move you from one wing to another because they were in, you know, cleaning the wing, hosing it, and so on. And what they did, they put you through what's called a mercer. They went into what's, you know, the ablution area, the toilets, you know, and there'll be four or five screws standing there, and there would be a mirror, and they would say, right, over the mirror, and they say, right, bend, you wouldn't bend, and then they would start kicking to beat you down. It would really depend on who was on, what temperament they had, what had happened the night before, earlier, or whatever. You just didn't know what way that was going to go. But it was all, it was very rare that, you know, somebody, at least somebody wasn't beat up, you know. Wasn't always the case that everyone was beat up. I think I would have took too much out of them. But, you know, you usually touched in some way. And also depended on your resistance. Like, see when they say get over the mirror, right, Ben, see when they kick the back of your legs? I didn't really resist. It was like token resistance. Joe McDonald would not bend. Joe McDonald, a screw actually came to me years later and said, Joe McDonald, he says, he is the strongest person I ever came across. He says, the hardest person I've ever came across, you know. Because Joe was just like, it was as if he had iron rods in his leg, and they booted away. They booted away at him to get him down. Joe was very, very committed. Joe wouldn't even take visits. He had a family. He had two children. He had a wife.
What, did he not know?
No. After a couple of years, we took visits. We were telling you about communication.
Yeah.
You put the gear on just to go out to visit, and then you take it off again. Joe wouldn't even do that. Joe was very, very committed. The problem, Joe was next door to me. The problem with Joe was, depending what way they did the wing shift. So if they were doing the wing shift anti-clockwise, I would go before him. And that was fine, usually fine, okay? Say if we were doing it anti-clockwise, I would come immediately after him. Now, the problem with Joe was, because Joe wouldn't bend, he'd have them wind up to him because he wouldn't bend. So therefore, whenever I come in behind him, I had screws all over. I was victim. You know what? I would have got it.
What was it like when you got out, like trying to adjust it back to normal life, like in 94?
Obviously, it was great to get out, to be back with your family. It was strange, clearly. Yeah. There was a lot of strangeness. I mean, the world had moved on.
Yeah.
It was difficult crossing the road because you couldn't really judge. Money was a big problem because you had no idea where you were going to shop or much something would cost. You had no idea. And you didn't want to pretend, you didn't want to be stupid, you know, counting your money out, so on.
Yeah.
So what you tended to do was you always give notes. So you ended up with a big pocket of, you know, coins. Because of that, because you're constantly giving notes. Because you felt a bit silly. You felt as if people knew, you know, is there something wrong with you, son? You know, you should have the money ready to pay for something, which you didn't, because you didn't know. Right. It was great to be out with the family. It was great to get round and seeing old friends. The world had moved on. You know, people who had knocked about were all, you know, were all teenagers. They were married now with children and so on. And they had busy lives then. And what happened was you tended just to be with your comrades and who were similar situations yourself. We tended to knock about together.
Did you met up with the people who you were inside with and like absolutely. People that you would have done the escape with? Did you like to speak about all what
absolutely.
Happened
and we tended to knock about together. And that would have been the case for maybe a year or so. But then we find partners. We have jobs then as well, you know, and then we're moving on. Even though, by the way, still part of the Republican movement, I'm still an active member of Sinn Féin. I've never ever left that, nor will I. But your life does change, you know.
How did you get into teaching? Or what? Like when you
always knew I'd be a teacher.
Oh, yeah.
And my father was a teacher, and he absolutely loved it. And I said, that'll do me.
So what did your parents think when you were obviously putting yourself forward for a hunger strike? Were they not like, Jim, what the fuck are you doing? Like,
it was absolutely terrible. It really was.
Could they not say, but they not even send the Bobby Sands and stuff like
it was, I would be no different from mine, but I would say all the families would say, I mean, that's Shiggy, Pat Shane. I mean, his parents come up and said to him, listen, we really want you to think about this hunger strike, because they said to him, your sister, we just got word that your sister's got leukemia, and like, really, the family can't take much more.
But Shiggy did he still do it?
Shiggy went ahead with it. You know?
Did he die?
No.
No, he's in the MLA. Pat Shane's in the MLA.
He's in the MLA.
Three of them.
No, it was something like 50 days in hunger strike. He was the last one. That's when it ended.
Three of them were from Belfast, weren't they? It was Bobby Sands,
Bobby, Joe,
Joe
and Kieran. Bobby, Joe,
they're
and Kieran.
They're all from Belfast?
Bobby, Joe and Kieran.
Yeah. And was the rest from down south, or were they just a...
No, they were all... Well, I mean, just tell you, run through. Frank Hughes was Balaki. Raymond McCreesh was South Armagh. Patsy O'Hare was Derry City. Then we had Kevin. Kevin Lynch was from Dungiven. And then you had Kieran. Martin Horsens was from Caha and Tyrone. Tom Michael Wee was from Balaki as well. And then you had Red Mickey Devine was from Derry.
For
us to try and imagine it, that's all we can do, but you've actually lived it and experienced it.
I can honestly say extremely privileged and proud to have been part of that, to have spent time along with them men. I'm totally under debt. I'll never forget them, and be the same with all the lads. You'll never forget them. Totally under debt. And as I said, it was the best of times and the worst of times. The best of times because I've never experienced that tight bond like that before. How everybody looked out for each other all the time. And again, that was part of the hunger strike. You know, I'm not telling lads, I'm not letting them down, you know. So, and then of course, it was the worst of times because you were separated from your loved ones. You were going through terrible conditions. Beatings was part and parcel, holdings was part and parcel. Anything they could do, you know, like mess about your food, turn lights on and off. Anything that they could do, that's what they did during that period, you know. And I have to say, there's another thing I'd like to say this as well. See, any time any of them showed any humanity, I had nothing respect for them because it went totally against the culture. The culture was, they're Fenians, get into them, they're this, they're that. And if anybody, even if something simple like, I couldn't believe it, do you want the light left on? Well, they turned it off. Do you need that water filled? It took your breath away, it really did. And you admire that person. And that person would have to be very careful because if he said that in front of others, he would become a victim. Because he's going against the culture and he's showing them up and they didn't like that. There was a culture there, you get into them. And if you didn't get into them, you were showing them up and they didn't want that. And then you were ostracized and victimized yourself over that. So it took, I would say that some of those screws who were involved in all that just hadn't got the strength to stand up and say, no, I don't want to do that, because they didn't want to be victims. Some screws are,
it's like the same on both sides, and kind of like they're trying to not give in and show any signs of weakness, and yous are doing the exact same thing, really. Like,
No. We were totally committed to ours. What it was, I believe, with some of them was they didn't want to be part of it, and they weren't committed to it, by the way. They saw what was going on, and I honestly think some of them didn't want to be part of it, but weren't strong enough to stand up to the other, the culture.
Yeah.
Because this is the thing about screws. Screws aren't liked by anybody. Both communities aren't liked. And what they tended to do was then they hung about with each other. They socialized in the camp. There was a social club in the camp. So their life was the camp, basically. Basically, that was their life. And therefore, for them to be ostracized, victimized, that would have been really tough for them. You know, so it would take a strong character to stand up to that. There weren't many, but there were a few. Now, one person I'll never forget, he was the principal officer in H5. He wasn't there all the time. Kevin Lappin. You heard me talking about the wing shifts and the mirror and how whenever you went in the blues and stuff, it was an excuse to get beat. See, when that man, we called him Dahi Nullig, that means Daddy Christmas. We always pray when there's a wing shift, hopefully Kevin's on, hopefully Dahi Nullig's on. Because he was on, he would normally stand over the wing shift in that ablution turret to ensure that there was nobody was beat up. See if he went away. I remember before, he was standing over watching everything. He went away, I don't know, phone call, whatever it was. And see, until he came back, everyone was beat. And so people like that, there are very few and far between.
But it made a difference.
Oh. And your total respect for him.
You don't forget him still, even this day. You haven't forgotten him.
We'll never forget him. Yeah. And I'm really glad to say, because big Lorne McKeown, who was on the hunger strike, he went 70 days on the hunger strike. He wrote quite a few books and plays and so on. Lorne McKeown went and visited him, which was good. Mm-hmm. You know, just to say to him, we really appreciated what you did.
Yeah, it just goes to show you, it's not total hatred.
It came because of that environment, you know, and what they were doing. But as I said, and possibly we did, you know, we painted them all with the one brush, which was wrong. But I did experience, there were some there, you could see, there was a reluctance.
But Jim, see, for anyone watching, just before we wrap up, your book, where can they find it if they want to?
6,000 Days. Well, you can get it on Amazon UK.
Right.
And also you can get it on, it's a shop called An Ishog. That means the lark. Mm-hmm. And it's beside the Sinn Féin Centre on the Falls Road at the corner of Sevastopol Street. You can also get it in the Culturland. There's a few other shops you can get it in, but they're the two that come to mind. But you can get it in Amazon UK.
And it's about, basically,
It's more. It's that whole period of going into a situation where there was no political status. They weren't sure what was going to happen. Then it goes into the protest. Then it goes into the hunger strike. Then it goes into the escape. And then what happened after the escape trial and things like that and so on. And then about how we still kept on fighting for better conditions and so on. It is basically a history of the Hitch Blocks. Because I said I was there 17 and a half years. I was there when I remember we were moving in the Hitch Blocks and we still had the cement and the wheelbarrows and the spades and all, because we were one of the blocks.
See the bar I drink in? They've got a big hang of the Hitch Blocks. It's actually cut from.
Yes, Hitch, yeah.
So they've cut around it and it's framed in the bar and the stones yes. are.
That's why I call it Hitch Blocks. It's a hitch. Okay. See, you've got the two legs. The bar in the middle is the control centre. It's known as the circle because of the old prisons. The way they had it, it was a panopticon, they call it, where they could see from the circle, you could look down and see all the wings. Obviously, you couldn't do that with the Hitch Block, but they still call it the circle. The bar across is a circle, and on either side, you've got the long legs. That was two wings on either side.
The hunger striker Hitch isn't for hunger striker?
No, it's a Hitch Block.
Bollocks. That was hunger striker.
No, it's Hitch Block.
Well, Jimmy, thank you for coming on. I really enjoyed that.
Delighted to say, especially ex-pupils on May the 5th.
Yeah.
You know, that's so harsh. I'm delighted.
Bobby Sands died today.
44.
40, was it?
44 years ago.
Yeah.
God bless it.
44 years. And when we're long gone, he'll still be spoken about, as will the other lads.
Worldwide figure,
yeah.
Like
yeah, it's great. It's great. His mural is the most pictured mural in the world. The one that the side of Sinn Féin Center, the Falls Road.
Yeah.
But it's good, like us being from a younger generation, to like hear, because we only hear the stories. I've never met someone.
Yeah.
I've heard stories of Bobby Sands, and like they're very. In our community, they would be seen as like fucking. Like we're fucking Cristiano Ronaldo deals.
Yes,
but I never actually got to talk to someone.
Well, I was fortunate that, and I knew him and spent time with him. And you asked me like, what was he like? I mean,
like as a person?
He was different. You just knew it. Somebody once he walked into a room, he makes an impact. You just know it right away. Makes an impact. I remember coming into the Crumb, and I explained to you that we weren't really sure what we were going to do. See, the minute he came into that Crumb, he was organising.
Leader, right?
Leadership, absolutely. Organising right away. He set up wee classes, doing ranks and Irish classes, and he had PRO, you know, writing out, doing publicity and so on, right away. And you just see the change taking place. And then he come up into our wing during the protest and the blanket protest. Once again, he was at it, organising. This is what we're going to do. We're going to do this. We're going to do that. Boys says, boys that. Leadership. And very, very talented as well. Fantastic.
Stuff I've seen him.
See the stories. You know, at night we would tell, you know, keep ourselves amused. He would tell stories, you know, about books and so on. Brilliant entertainer. And singer, a fantastic singer.
Didn't he write that song, was it him?
The Road If You Wrote
Back Home and Derry.
I Wish I Was Back Home and Derry.
Christy Moore sings it, but he wrote it, didn't he?
He wrote it. He sent it out
to Christy Moore. That's crazy.
His granddaughter, is it, sorry?
Granddaughter. She's a singer.
And because he only has a son. He didn't have a daughter. And then he has another one. I think Beck actually wrote the Marcella, which was his sister, and that was a pen name, which he used as well, Marcella. Very, very talented. But I say he's somebody who sticks out. He's somebody who sticks out, and clearly had. And you know, he was the man who was prepared to die. He was the man who knew he was probably going to have to die, because the press probably would have thought the previous one was brinkmanship. You know.
Tell me, this, Jim, before you go, did you have a full head of hair back then?
I did.
You did.
I did. I'll never forget it. Actually, see when the protest ended, because with long hair and beards and also, you know, and we're getting a haircut. It was Cormac McArt. Cormac lived just across the road there in Moyard. Cormac's cutting the hair, and he goes, "Oh, look at you! You're losing that hair." And I said, "Catch yourself on. There's no way I'm going to lose." I convinced once again I wasn't going to go bald. I was not going to go bald because my father and all them, they had a good head of hair. I couldn't believe it, but it took a while. I never forget whenever I started teaching. I was teaching the school actually quite close to here. Vera Foster, it's gone now.
It's not down now.
I was subbing at Vera Foster, and it was a lovely summer's day. And of course, some of them ones, you know, at the Corpus Christi were on the beak and they were across the fence, right? And they were throwing in the, you know, the water balloons, right?
Right.
And I'll never forget this. And one of them shouted, "Get the baldy bastard." And I'm going, I'm looking around the yard saying to myself, please be somebody baldy in this yard. Couldn't be me. I said, am I baldy? I remember going home and you checking the head. That's what happened. Well, lost my hair.
Appreciate you coming on, mate.
No, privilege.
Where's the best place to get your book to support you? Because some place, obviously, you can get it on Amazon, or if you go and buy it.
I would say the best place would be on Aishog. Yeah. Like, again, it's, you know, Sinn Féin Centre, the shop beside the Sinn Féin Centre, corner Falls Road and Sebastopol Street. And plus, all the books in there are signed. By the way, I signed all the books in there as well.
Happy
days. Good stuff.
That'll be the best. Calderland, you can get them in the Calderland.
So anyone looking a bit of history, be sure to check it out.
Yeah.
Been a good week. Thank
you for coming on, Jim. Yeah. That was a great story you told me.
Every day is a school day for us as well. Do you know what I mean? It's like a wee history lesson or kind of.
That's it. We're lifelong learners.
I enjoyed that.
Yeah. Appreciate it, mate. Thank you.
Not at all. Pleasure.
Do you ever watch A Troubled Land? It's on YouTube. What do you call it? A Troubled Land.
Colmena Seguros presenta una historia imparable.
Cuando uno de mis trabajadores sufrió un accidente en la empresa, sentí miedo. Pensaba en él, en su familia y en todo lo que podía pasar. Pero la verdad, ese miedo duró poco, porque Colmena Seguros estuvo a nuestro lado, guiándonos y acompañándonos para que la recuperación fuera más rápida. Hoy mi empresa sigue adelante, con la tranquilidad y respaldo de Colmena.
Colmena Seguros, la aseguradora de las empresas que no paran de salir adelante.
Vigilado Superintendencia Financiera de Colombia. Colmena Seguros, una empresa de Fundación Grupo Social.